From Texas to Vermont, Hawaii to Virginia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, confirmation hearings for President Trump's Supreme Court Justice nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, are set to begin next week. Tom Gipping from the Heritage Foundation is here to talk about her background and qualifications. The first presidential debate is history, and it was a real slugfest, but will it have an impact on the race? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. It could take days, if not weeks, after the November election to determine who has been elected president. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why Pennsylvania could become the Florida of 2000 in the process. And social media has taken center stage in the political debate, but is it very social? Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, talks about the lack of social media civility on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Amy Coney Barrett has been nominated for a seat on the Supreme Court of the United States by President Donald Trump, and her confirmation seems assured. So let's learn a little bit about our likely next justice. Tom Gipping is Deputy Director of the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He's here with some background on Judge Barrett. Tom, welcome to American Radio Journal. Tom, before we start talking about the nominee's judicial philosophy, give us a little bit of background. Who is Amy Coney Barrett?
She grew up in near New Orleans, the oldest of seven children, a Roman Catholic family. I'll tell you, she had not only an educational record, but about the best kind of record you could achieve. I mean, she went to Rhodes College, got a bachelor's in English literature, but graduated magna cum laude. Then she went to Notre Dame, graduated first in her law class, summa cum laude. After law school, she clerked for two very significant judges, one Lawrence Silberman on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and then Justice Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court. And I think that gave her a kind of grounding in basic principles from America's founding about what the judiciary's role is and how judges should approach their job. She and her husband, Jesse, who is an attorney and a former federal prosecutor, they have seven children, five of their own, and they adopted two children from Haiti. They live in South Bend, Indiana. She taught at Notre Dame Law School, her alma mater, for 15 years, and three different times a graduating class voted her the Distinguished Professor of the Year. She is just beloved by everyone she's worked with, by her students, by scholars across the country, by people who agree and disagree with her particular legal views. And I'm really excited about the nomination.
You were co-author of an op-ed on the subject of what type of a justice she would be. And in that op-ed, you wrote that she said, "The text of the Constitution controls, so the meaning of the words at the time they were ratified is the same as their meaning today." Is that sort of a window to the judicial soul of Amy Coney Barrett?
It really is. The founders of our country designed our system of government overall and designed the role that the judiciary would play in that system. And that design means that when judges interpret a written text, that whether it's the Constitution or a statute, what they're trying to do is not just read the words, but they're trying to determine what the author meant by what the author wrote. That's what interpretation is. And when judges go beyond that, it's really the judge determining what they want the Constitution to mean or what they want a statute to mean. And that's too much power. The judiciary was not designed to have that much power. And so that's the approach that the judiciary was designed to take. And the great thing about Judge Barrett is when she was a scholar, she wrote extensively on those very subjects: constitutional interpretation, statutory construction, precedent, and those bear directly on what she understands the proper role of a judge, how a judge should go about approaching their cases. And that's that traditional way of looking at it, where the judge starts with a text, and his goal is to determine what that text originally meant, and judges don't have authority to change that meaning. I mean, that in a nutshell is what interpretation is all about for her. She said when the president announced her nomination in the Rose Garden on the 26th of September, she said, Justice Scalia's judicial philosophy is my judicial philosophy. And I'll tell you, more encouraging words I could not have heard, because that approach is well established. It's consistent with the way the judiciary was designed. And I believe she'd be a person who would be consistent with that approach. Sometimes judges drift here and there over time, but I think she's truly committed to it.
By tying herself to the late justice, certainly, Tom, she did send a signal to all of us wanting to know what kind of a justice she would be. She has further written, and when you talk about how she would interpret statutes as opposed to applying the Constitution, Tom, she said that plain words mean exactly what they say. Plain words. This steers us away from the type of activism that we've seen in courts of many levels, correct?
I think that's right. We have to decide in our system of government who's supposed to run the country. In a representative democracy, a republic like we have, it's you and me. It's the American people and those they elect. And when Congress passes a statute, Congress doesn't just throw random words on a piece of paper and hand it over to judges to figure out the rest. Judges are supposed to take that statute for what it says and take it seriously. If we have judges who do that and who don't say to the legislative branch that they'll do their job for them, I think that puts more pressure on our members of Congress to do their job well, to write statutes that mean something, to take responsibility for what the law actually says. And that's why I think that kind of judge is really healthy and good for our overall system of government.
Another key factor here is her approach to precedent and the fact that justices and judges often look at what they called settled law. And Justice, soon to be Justice Barrett, has indicated that she's not going to look at what is settled law, but is actually going to go back to the Constitution and its meaning. Do you see this as also a departure from the norm?
Well, I wouldn't say that she'd say she's not going to pay attention to settled law. Every judge does. Past decisions of the Supreme Court do matter, and they are part of the overall body of law that judges use. But, you know, a precedent is basically what the Supreme Court has said about the Constitution. A precedent is not the Constitution itself. So judges have to decide when they should stick with past decisions and when, as the Supreme Court has done many times, they have to change those past decisions because sometimes courts make mistakes that have to be corrected. I think Judge Barrett has actually written extensively on the Latin term is stare decisis, the degree to which and the ways that courts should pay attention to past decisions and when it's appropriate to depart from them.
We have been talking with Thomas Gipping, who is Deputy Director of the Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, that at the Heritage Foundation, based in Washington, D.C. Tom, tell us a little bit about the Heritage Foundation. Also, can you give us a website where folks can go to read your article and other scholarship from the Heritage Foundation on this topic?
Sure. The Heritage Foundation is the world's leading conservative think tank. You can go to heritage.org/supreme-court. That's a special page that we've created on our website.
Thomas Gipping of the Heritage Foundation. Tom, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He's had a busy week. We had a presidential debate. We have much activity in Congress. We have campaigns all over the country. We're going to start out talking about presidential politics. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
Well, the first presidential debate is now history, Scott. And we've seen sometimes where these presidential debates have been real turning points in elections. It may be safe to say that this past week's debate was unlike any other. I would be interested in your thoughts. Does it really have much impact politically on the direction of the race?
Well, I think it's both sides putting out a political narrative of what the final month of the presidential election is going to be about and how that trickles into other races for the United States Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives. From the debate, we obviously saw President Trump take a pretty strong stand in his constitutional ability to make a nomination for the Supreme Court with Judge Barrett. We also saw him sort of lay out his vision for continuing to rebuild the economy following the coronavirus pandemic. And then we saw a pretty interesting back and forth between the two candidates on healthcare. And obviously the left has been trying to shape that narrative of healthcare into the Supreme Court battle as well over this big fight on pre-existing conditions. So you really got both sides that are just digging in here. But what we saw during the debate was obviously a primetime example of both candidates really getting aggressive with each other and name-calling, and that's the type of politics I think that we're in right now, and how that filters down into actual policymaking and how it filters down into political battles at those other levels that I mentioned is what I'm interested in watching over the next month.
Typically, Scott, these debates are at least partially an exercise in trying to bring uncommitted or independent voters into your camp. What you've just outlined seems to be more of a base strengthening exercise on both sides. Do you see now that there really isn't much middle or much undecided left, and this is more an exercise in turnout?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the polling, you're going to understand that the name identification for Donald Trump and Joe Biden is about as high as it's ever been for two presidential candidates. And you have a pretty strong opinion of the president, and a lot of people have an opinion of Joe Biden over his 47 years. And so contrasting the two of them on ideological issues, if you're an independent voter, you kind of have settled at that point. There's not a lot of folks that just haven't figured out who they prefer. The real question is, how does the coronavirus impact turnout? How does the Supreme Court battle impact voter enthusiasm on both sides? And the bottom line is that we know this is going to be a very, very close election, decided by a percent here and there in several of the battleground states. So I certainly think that the independent voter of the mid-90s has become smarter and more partisan and ideological over the last generation.
Let's talk a little bit more about this Supreme Court nomination, Scott. Amy Coney Barrett has begun the process of going around talking to U.S. senators. Scott, a number of Democrat senators are saying, we're not even going to meet with her. Is this a white flag of surrender or a calculated political move on their part?
Well, I think it's the latter. I think that this is certainly calculated by the left. Barrett has met with, I think, about 16 to 20 Republican senators over the week, and she'll be continuing to do meetings and checking off the folks that are on the committee, and then also, obviously, important swing votes. I think some of these members, it's more of a courtesy meeting. They know that they've voted for her for circuit judge, and they intend to support her for Supreme Court justice. But what I would expect is actually Democrats to try to find ways to delay the process. And one way that they might do that is by requesting meetings with Barrett the week before the committee hearing. And Judge Barrett's ability to prepare for the confirmation battle through the committee and the Senate floor. So if they can throw her off of her mark and, you know, continue to slow things down by saying, oh, well, we didn't actually have a chance to meet with her. She was meeting with Republicans. This is going too fast. They're just trying to use that as a wedge to ultimately defeat her. But the good news is, for your Republican and conservative listeners, I believe strongly that Judge Barrett has the votes to be confirmed as Supreme Court Justice.
To that end, then, Scott, does any of this really matter? Does it really matter whether or not any senators meet with her? Aside from messaging, does the confirmation hearing even matter? Because it would appear from the comments made by a majority of senators that this is a foregone conclusion.
Well, it's a foregone conclusion for the left, too, in terms of opposition. We've heard from Kamala Harris and Chuck Schumer and Richard Blumenthal and others that said immediately when she was nominated that they would not support her nomination. And so I think that there are a lot of folks that are sort of dug in here. She has certainly a stellar record and a lot of writings and opinions to look into. And there are going to be folks that do want to do that research just because it's due diligence in terms of advice and consent of the Senate on a nomination. And I think that there are a lot of senators that take that role very seriously. You're seeing a lot less Republican senators saying that they will absolutely support her in a vote on confirmation, and instead they're highlighting the qualities that they see in her ability to be a justice.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, a couple of words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. And if your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. And our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Court rulings have upended the election process in Pennsylvania and could turn the Keystone State into the Florida of 2000, when the outcome of that year's presidential election hinged on its electoral votes. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why.
Imagine this scenario playing out on November 3rd. Incumbent President Donald Trump and Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden are running neck and neck as the results roll in on election night. Trump is once again losing the popular vote, but he's winning in enough states that he's got a real shot at a second term. And as the night wears on, it becomes apparent that Pennsylvania's 20 electoral votes may very well prove decisive. It could certainly be that close once again. In 2016, Trump won Pennsylvania by less than 50,000 votes. It was one of a few Rust Belt states that helped tip President Trump over top of Hillary Clinton in that very close election. This time around, imagine a situation where the race is so close, perhaps even closer than last time in Pennsylvania, that pundits are already raising the prospect of a recount even before election night has ended. But there are numerous complications in that scenario. There could be hundreds of thousands of mailed-in ballots that arrived at county election offices in the weeks before Election Day that are only starting to be counted on November 3rd. More mail-in ballots will be delivered on Wednesday and Thursday and Friday, and they will all be counted. While the days pass and the results slowly tip towards Biden, allegations of voter fraud fly around social media. The president tweets angrily, of course, about Democrats stealing the election, and so many lawsuits are filed that it's impossible to keep track of all of them. It almost seems certain that the whole thing, in that scenario, would end up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at just one of, I guess there's probably many, potential nightmare scenarios surrounding the 2020 presidential election. And for the most part, I think those scenarios are kind of overblown. I don't think there's a lot of reason to get worked up about crises that may come to pass. And that goes really for both sides. Republicans who are worried about mass voter fraud or some sort of conspiracy to steal the election from the president, and for Democrats who are worried about the possibility that something like Trump refusing to leave the White House if he's defeated could happen. And if there is a nightmarish, chaotic ending to what's already been one of the most unpredictable campaign seasons in American history, there's a good chance that Pennsylvania will be at the center of it. And there's a good chance that two somewhat under-the-radar decisions made last month by the state's election officials and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court will be the reason why. The first of those decisions was made on September 15th when the Pennsylvania Department of State issued new guidance telling counties not to reject mail-in ballots solely because of mismatched or missing signatures. That clarification was made in response to a lawsuit that was triggered by the fact that more than 26,000 mail-in ballots were rejected during Pennsylvania's primary election earlier this year for signature issues. Now, counties will have to flag those ballots and give voters the chance to appear in person to verify that, yes, indeed, those ballots are legit. Then, on September 17th, just 2 days later, the state Supreme Court ordered counties to accept mail-in ballots that arrive up to 3 days after the November 3rd election, as long as they were postmarked on or before Election Day. But there's a potential wrinkle here. Ballots that are received within that period that lack a postmark or any other proof of mailing should be presumed to have been mailed by Election Day, the Supreme Court said, unless there is some evidence to suggest that they were not. Now, both decisions are driven by a desire to avoid accidentally disenfranchising people who have legitimately cast their ballots. And it's important, of course, to note that in-person voting reduces common mistakes that voters sometimes make, like voting for too many candidates or failing to sign a ballot. These things are far more likely to happen with absentee or mailed-in ballots. This year's equivalent of the 2000 presidential election's famous Hanging Chads incident is likely to be this very inexact science of trying to determine whether a signature on an absentee ballot matches the one on the voter roll. Now, even before these changes were made, Trump's campaign and the president himself had been arguing that the expanded use of mail-in voting due to the COVID-19 pandemic will be ripe for fraud. That is, strictly speaking, not true. In fact, studies show that absentee and mail-in ballots are no more vulnerable to fraud than in-person voting, and that increased rates of mail-in balloting do not tip elections towards either Republicans or Democrats. Now, even so, rewriting huge parts of the state's election protocol just weeks before the election carries a heavy stench of political favoritism, particularly when it was all done by a Democratic administration and a state Supreme Court with a Democratic majority. And yes, thanks to the weirdness of Pennsylvania's election rules, judges in Pennsylvania, they're technically nonpartisan, but they are elected in partisan contests, and the majority of them on the Supreme Court at the moment are Democrats. The perception of partisan politics shaping election rules could undermine the legitimacy of the election's outcome if it all comes down to Pennsylvania. And it could undermine the legitimacy of the election even in the absence of voter fraud or any actual legitimate issues. And again, it really could all come down to Pennsylvania. The latest forecast at 538 predicts that Pennsylvania is the most likely tipping point state, that is, the state that puts either Biden or Trump over that all-important 270 electoral vote threshold. In fact, Pennsylvania is so important, 538 says, that if Trump wins the state, he has an 84% chance of being reelected. But if Biden wins the state, he has a 96% chance of winning the election. So if chaos unfolds in Pennsylvania in the days after November 3rd, you can blame the Democratic administration that has changed some of the election laws, and you can blame the Democrats on the state Supreme Court who have played politics with their most recent ruling. But you can also save at least a little bit of blame for the state's Republican-controlled legislature, which has stubbornly refused to consider a number of simple changes that could have smoothed out some problems in the state's election law. Maybe the most important of those changes is a proposal to allow county officials to begin opening and counting mail-in ballots before Election Day, something that most other states allow and that could speed up the process of determining a winner, but something that is currently illegal in Pennsylvania. Indeed, it's almost certain that, barring a shockingly large landslide, Pennsylvania won't be able to declare a winner in the presidential race on election night, and probably not even for days or weeks afterward. Remember, the state is going to consider as legitimate any ballots that arrive at polling places even up to 3 days after the election. So if the state's 20 electoral votes could swing the outcome of the election, all of America might be wondering why Pennsylvania has made such a mess of things. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the election, including my latest piece on some of these theories about why Pennsylvania could be the Florida of the 2020 race at Reason.com. And I'll be right back here next week with a guest on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Social media is often anything but social, with civility lacking in many digital conversations. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, talks about his experience with social media on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Progressives have been decrying President Trump's demeanor since before he was elected in 2016. From what I have seen, though, the left should examine its own conscience. Even before he was a candidate for president, Masters of Ceremonies enjoyed harsh and at times cruel bashing of then-citizen Donald Trump. I'm certain that President Trump would not survive his presidency should he not respond to such personal attacks in the manner in which he does. Similar demonic attacks, sometimes in the name of humor, have been delivered unceremoniously to Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Justices Thomas, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch, and Justice nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett. The absolute vile trashing of people with whom you disagree is an affront to all of us, our way of life, and for many of us, our faith. As a conservative currently running for re-election in the state House of Representatives, this is an actual expletive-deleted transcript from a person on our webpage who was upset that we took down an obscene post that the person, in fact, posted on our webpage. Our IT department emailed the person about the reasons for the removal of the post. This is the person's response. Expletive-deleted. Off. How you like them apples, in all caps. Meme showing expletive deleted gesture. All caps. Want to message me some more? I don't ask about you. Expletive deleted. Why do you have to bother me? A loser meme. What an idiot meme. Idiot loser in caps. Fake Catholic in caps. Expletive deleted was the next comment. Trump expletive deleted liquor. Want to message me now more? This went on for the better part of a half an hour, with no response from me or our IT department. We were concerned about the safety of our staff as the tirade went on for an extended period. This conduct is symptomatic of social media and the absolute ugly public discourse, which seems intent on personal attacks and shaming as a means of destroying an opponent rather than debating ideas. Similar comments can be made about the conduct of people hiding their horrific behavior behind the COVID-19 masks, which seems to give them some perceived degree of anonymity to engage in conduct that they would not normally engage in. The deteriorating nature of public discourse and the disdain with which some people interact with one another are even more troubling when one realizes that this behavior by adults in a public forum sets an example for the children who are actively engaged in that same forum. Adults are inadvertently condoning such behavior and then act surprised when their children and grandchildren engage in similar behavior. Whenever disagreements between people in a civilized society reach the point of anger and disrespect, our entire society must be concerned. As a legislator, I frequently hear people complain about the lack of cooperation in the government and demand bipartisan solutions, while at the same time, they trash or vilify anyone who disagrees with them on virtually every social media forum. Our political process is merely a reflection of our society. This feigned perspective that our government must be above the fray while we are engaged in social media hatred is incomprehensible. The fallacy of logic called argumentum ad hominem is one in which a person is attacked and vilified versus the person's position, thereby negating any civilized conversation and resolution of conflict. Coping skills are essential to allow for civil discourse and for the advancement of society. Coping skills reflect the character of a nation. The character of a nation and its core values determine whether or not we will survive. Many Americans today are confused about our national character and how we cope with those changes. What we stand for is not as clear as it once was for many, and how we interact with one another has certainly deteriorated. The significance of this debate is quite simple. If you undermine a nation's core value, you undermine the nation. Until we achieve a mutual respect for one another and learn to disagree respectfully, our nation will never tackle our most difficult challenges. We could be doomed to failure. The next time you respond to someone, I would encourage you to determine whether or not you're acting with compassion, understanding, and persuasive logic. Your response says as much about you as it does our nation. The confirmation process for Judge Amy Coney Barrett will be judged as our chance to constructively debate ideas, or it could become a national tragedy again. The stakes are real for our national character and for the people who we say that we are. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WJPH-FM in Woodbine, New Jersey, KSOO-AM in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, along with WBFD-AM in Bedford, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the cost of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.